profit from the presence of all these people in workshops or programs to really feed into the Simon Center main seminar, which is today, on Tuesdays. So I'm looking forward to this talk because the title is absolutely fascinating, Computation Without Representation.
Thank you. So, maybe I should explain. Wait. People coming in should be getting a copy of the handout. So, maybe I should explain sort of what I have against representations. So, other than that, they're hard. You need to learn all about them and so on. But the moment you use representation theory for computations in the kind of things that I do, you immediately are led to tensor powers of these representations. Tensor powers grow very, very, very quickly in size, and so any computation you do is going to take an exponential amount of time. Andras, copy of the handout. And since I actually have specific computations that I want to to end in my lifetime, I care. Okay? So I want to tell you about an alternative which is both faster and better. I actually mean it, better. Okay? So but let me start. My talk will follow a handout. I think you already got this, and I hope you're all holding a copy. Thank you for inviting me to the Simons Center. I sort of also apologize because my talk is a little bit off topic. And the reason is because something good happened to it, namely it shrunk. It became easier and easier and easier. Shrinking is good things in mathematics. Well, anyway, it shrunk and shrunk and shrunk, and it started, I mean, my motivation initially was very much within the topics of this, but somehow it shrunk away from it, sort of like, okay, contracted to a point away from. Anyway, and there is a website for the talk, and you can get the handout from there if you want to, and there will be a link to the video eventually. Everything I do follows Rozanski and Overbay. The references are on the handout and is joint work with Roland van der Veen. And here are these distinguished people. And maybe I'll start. So this is the knotted candies, the first 250 knots. And it's kind of, Misha, you have to take a copy of the handout. And People think that the main problem in knot theory is to separate those. It's actually a bit different than that, but let's start with separating. So, I mean, look at this one and that one. I mean, how on earth are you going to tell if they're the same or not? Okay? So one way is to find invariants. So you find a function from the space of knots, a computable function from the space of knots to a space in which things are easy to tell apart, like polynomials, matrices, something. And then if that function attains a different value on this one than on that one, then you know that they're different. Okay? But actually, that's a limited view of what knot theory is about. So think of these as the integers. This is like telling apart the integers. But the integers also have properties, like some integers are the sum of two squares and some integers are not the sum of two squares. You cannot even say this property unless you have the language that allows you to say such things, namely unless you have operations, squaring and addition in the case of the problem about integers that I've just mentioned. So let me tell you about the portfolio or a portfolio of operations that I care about for knot theory and that I want my invariants to respect. Okay? So here is the whole portfolio in one small picture. Okay? So first of all, you can look at it from afar and it's modeled on the trefoil knot. Right? Sort of if you kind of ignore the annotations, it's roughly the trefoil knot. So I basically wanted it to resemble a knot. But this knot is made of pieces. So one piece, like here, is a single crossing. So I want my invariants to make sense on pieces. The piece could be a single crossing, or it could be the complement of this crossing, so a complicated so-called tangle. A tangle is a piece of a knot with some pieces cut out, if you wish. So I want my invariants to make sense on these things. I want my invariants to be well-behaved with respect to several operations. So the first of those would be the... I'm not touching the screen. The first of those would be disjoint union. So, like, I could think of this whole thing as the disjoint union of a crossing, a messy thing here, a line, and a quap. A quap is a cup or a cap. And I have two of them in this, four of them in this picture, okay? But then I want some further operations. So I want the stitching operation M-I-J-K. So what's the stitching operation? So my tangles are supposed to have labeled components, called the labels I-J and K. And one operation would be to take the component labeled I with the and the component labeled J, stitch them together, call the result K. So in fact, this is what this dot here indicates. So I've stitched a component that was lying here to a quap, perhaps labeled J over here, and got a component, got a vertical strand with a little hook. Okay? Then there is the doubling operation. So if you have a component I, you can apply delta IJK to it, and it produces this, basically it takes this component and replaces it with two parallel copies, and here I've done it to one of the components, just so that you see what it looks like. Okay? And finally, there is this strand reversal operation SI. If you look at this knot, all the orientations are consistent, except the orientation of this strand, because I applied SI to it. Okay? Now, what's good about this operation, by the way, sort of a minor comment, which is often neglected, so the disjoint union operation is binary. All other operations are actually unary. I mean, I use notations that remind you of multiplication and co-multiplication, but they're actually unary operations because the input is an existing tangle, and the output is the tangle with two of its components stitched, or one of the components doubled. But all of these are actually unary operations. These are not, M is not a multiplication. It depends what you want to do. I can remove some of them, but then I'll be able to do less.
And they're acting on what?
They're acting on the space of tangles. Yeah. So tangles are pieces of knots.
This is somehow.
Not necessarily projected. I mean, I think you know, if I wanted to be fully formal, it would take me too long, and it's better to just have this sense. This is the sense. It's in this picture, and the precise formalities would take too long. Okay? And will not be terribly interesting. Okay? So, what do I have to say? First of all, with these operations, the world of knots or tangles is finitely generated, in fact, finitely presented. Basically, it's kind of obvious. You want to generate a knot, you throw on the plane all the crossings, and then you stitch them together, and you got a complicated knot. Right? It's kind of obvious from this picture. So in some sense it's easy to construct invariants because all you have is to define the invariants on the generators and specify how the operations act. And the more significant point is that some properties, so again, in the integers think about being the sum of two squares, but other properties such as the knot genus or the ribbon property of a knot become definable using these operations. And so if you have an invariant which is well behaved with respect to these operations, you get a chance of saying something about these operation, about these properties. Okay? And I could say a lot more about this, but not now. Okay? So So now I want an algebraic universe, again as the target of the invariant, in which all of these operations will make sense. And one standard such target space is the quantum group portfolio of spaces of in operations. Okay? So, well, you don't need to know the word quantum here. You just need to know that I need an algebra U. And once I have the algebra, I can look at all of its tensor powers. So I can look at it to the second tensor power, but I actually write it as tensor JK because I like to have the components of the tensor product labeled. So this will be two tensor factors, one labeled J, one labeled K. I can look at the algebra to the tensor I, which just means one copy of the algebra. I can look at the algebra tensor to the empty set, which just means the ground field, right? And then all of the things I talked about before are maps between these spaces. So the antipode is a map from UI to UI, U tensor to the I to U tensor to the I. The coproduct is a map from UI to U tensor JK. The stitching is a map from two copies to one. R matrix, the crossing, is an element here, but an element is just a map coming out of the rational numbers. You can think of the image of one as the element. Okay, and likewise the quap is here. Okay? So this is lovely, but awful from a computational perspective, because not only you have tensor powers here, and you'll have higher tensor powers if you had tangles with more components. Even worse, typically these algebras use U are infinite dimensional, and now I'm totally out of things to do. Okay? So really I want to simplify this picture. And the first step is to notice that that quantum groups, the algebras I care about, are so-called Poincaré-Birkhoff-Witt algebras. So there is some finite set B, depending on the algebra, of generators. And then the algebra U is isomorphic to the set of the symmetric algebra on these generators. Or if you want to think even more down to earth, polynomials in these generators, okay? And the isomorphism is not unique. The isomorphism depends on choosing an order. So basically, here you have unordered monomials in your set of generators, but then once you choose to put the y's before the x's, that's what this ordering operator does, then you just declare that when you will map them to the algebra, you will be mapping all the y's and putting them before all the x's. And then that would be an isomorphism. So you get the symmetric algebra portfolio of operations, which is shown here. And the spaces are now simple, but the operations are complicated because it's the multiplication operation is not the multiplication operation of polynomials, but the multiplication of operations that polynomials inherit by the isomorphisms to algebras above. Okay? And about my notation, so here I mean polynomials instead of in one copy of the alphabet of the generators, I take two copies of the alphabet, and I index one of them J and one of them K, and then the J copy correspond to the J tensor factor, and the K copy correspond to the K tensor factor. Okay. So, it seems that I need to understand a very, very simple category, namely the category whose objects are finite sets B. So these finite sets B are typically either one copy of my B or several copies of my a set of generators, but things like that, and whose morphisms are simply linear maps between this, between polynomials in B, so the morphisms between B and B prime will be linear maps between polynomials in B into polynomials in B prime. Okay? And differential operators, because it's really finite order differential operators, as you will see in a minute.
So, but you call maps, not just differential ones.
No, they're
you write all homomorphisms from S of B to S of B prime.
Well, it's draw is obnoxious.
Okay.
Now it's not differential operators. Okay. A different way, well, I mean, homomorphisms from this to that is like elements of the dual of that tensor that. And the dual will have a dual basis generated by a dual set of generators. So I will call the dual set of generators for B, B star. And then the homomorphisms are simply polynomials in B star and B prime. So where star is a certain list of generators dual to the generators in B. And by convention, the elements in B I will denote by Latin letters, the element of dual B I will denote by Greek letter, and without comment, I will declare that the dual of X is Xi, the dual of Y is Eta, and the dual of T is Tau, etc. Okay?
So polynomial means that this is a finite rank map, or?
So I'm still talking about finite rank, and then I will notice that this is not enough, and the whole issue is about how to complete it reasonably. Okay? Good. So what's the composition law? So if you have a function, an f going from sb0 to sb1, and a g going from s of b1 to s of b2, so really this is a polynomial in the variables in B1 and the dual of the variables in B0. This is a polynomial in the variables in B2 and the duals of the variables in B1, and you want to think how to compose them. So composing them, so doing F followed by G, or as written sometimes, G circle F, and then, well, so this is a map from here to here, but if I want to think of the tensor representing it, so if I want to think of the element of SB star comma B prime representing G circle F, you can check that it really means turning G into a differential operator, applying it to F, and evaluating it at zero in a certain place. So more precisely, it's you take G, you replace all the zetas that appear in it. So G is going from here to here. So sort of at its tail, it has Greek letters. At its head, it has Latin letters. So you replace all the Greek letters in G with differentiations with respect to the Latin letters, the corresponding Latin letters. Apply these differentiations to the polynomial to the Latin side of F, and if there are any leftovers, you kill them. So if there are any Latin letters left in F after the differentiation, you remove them. This is really an exercise. This is. I'm just telling you how to compose maps. I mean, it's okay. It's really okay. There is an alternative for. Really, what I'm telling you is that you use the pairing in the symmetric algebra. And the pairing in the symmetric algebra can be written using differentiation, or alternatively, it can be written in the opposite way using differentiation. So alternatively, you could have taken F, taken all the Latin letters in it, replace it by differentiations, apply them to the Greek letters of G, and then remove all the Greeks. Okay? So that's one property. And
remove all the Greeks.
Greek letters. Okay. And finally, it's actually rather easy to compute the tensorial representation of a morphism. Namely, if you have a function f from S of B to S of B prime, then and it's linear and continuous just means that sort of it doesn't lower degree by too much. So it doesn't, if you have high degree polynomial, it stays high degree at the output. Then, it extends to power series, yes. The way to compute its corresponding tensor is, well, you look at the exponential of essentially the identity map. So this is the identity map in the symmetric algebra. And you apply to it the operation f on the Latin side. Or said differently, you look at the exponential over all elements in the basis of zeta I of the sum of over all elements in the basis of zeta I times zi, and you apply to it the function f, which just means that you apply f to the z's. And that's very easy to check. So maybe I'll give a few examples. And the examples will immediately tell you that I shouldn't be working with polynomials, but with power series. Okay? So the identity map, the one variable identity map from polynomials in z to polynomials in z, is simply given by the exponential of z times zeta. I mean, how is it consistent with, Dennis, you have to take a copy of the handout or else you're not allowed to sit. This is really, it's either a very simple thing or it follows from Taylor's theorem. Basically, e to the z times zeta becomes differentiation with respect to z. Then that becomes, by Taylor's theorem, this is a shift in the direction of z, but then you set z to zero, so you end up doing nothing. Maybe I'm too confused to say it right, but I think you should get the point. Likewise, the multivariable identity map is given here. If you want to rename a variable, so if you have polynomials in zi and you want to turn them into polynomials in zj by just replacing every instance of zi with zj, then it's done using the exponential of zj times zeta I. The archetypal multiplication map. So our multiplication maps are harder. But just the multiplication map in a polynomial algebra. So the multiplication map in a if you multiply two polynomials, it just means, you think of them as elements in polynomials in zi and zj. And then all you have to do is to rename both zi and zj into zk. Okay, that has the effect of multiplying the two polynomials. So you can check that the corresponding tensor is e to the zk multiplied by zeta I plus zeta j. The archetypal coproduct, so the archetypal coproduct is the map which maps zi to zj plus zk. This is on polynomials or on tensor product of spaces. And then the corresponding tensor, the corresponding power series, is e to the zj plus zk multiplied by zi. You can check that. And then this is grayed out because I don't really want to talk about it. But if you look at the archetypal R matrix, it also tends to be the exponential of a Gaussian. And finally, if you look deep into the Weyl commutation relations, you find that they also look like, they also can be encapsulated, can be written using exponentials of quadratic things. So T here is a scalar, so this is really a quadratic. So basically what I need to know is now is not how to simply compose polynomials, which is done by turning them into differential operators, but rather how to compose Gaussians, And well, again, it is in some sense done into turning them into differential operators, but these differential operators are infinite order, so you have to be more careful. Okay? So now I need to tell you how to compose Gaussians. Okay? First, there is a minor issue that we have to get out of the way. So, you know, I have F and I have G, and I want to compose them by gluing, by identifying, by pairing many variables that appear in F, some zeta 1 i's, with many variables that appear in G, so some z 1 j's. Okay? It's handy to be able to do it step by step. But if you start binding things step by step, then after the first binding, they are no longer independent. So, you know, if you're trying to zip this to that, and you zip halfway, so you pair half the variables, the result is no longer a pair of things. It's a single, a pair of things. It's a single thing in which you want to pair some of the variables. So instead of telling you how to bind two things together, I have to tell you how to zip a single thing into itself. So let me define zipping. So if P is a polynomial in Greek and Latin letters, or maybe not a polynomial, but something for which convergence somehow makes sense, then I will define the zipping of this polynomial with respect to the variables that I've highlighted. So I only need to highlight one set of variables, because you always attach a variable to its dual, and I have a convention for how to, for what is the dual of zeta j, right? It's zj. So it's essentially given by the same formula as before. Namely, you take this polynomial, you put into the zeta j's differentiations with respect to zj, you apply it to your own coefficients. Okay, it's sort of like the way the divergence act on its own coefficient. Or said differently, you write the polynomial in such a way so that all the zetas appear to the left of all the z's. You replace all the zetas by differential operators, by differentiations, and you let them act on the z's that follow on the right, and then you set all the remaining z's, if some z's remain, you set them to zero. So that's zipping. Okay? So for example, if P is, the most general polynomial you can think of in two variables, then its zipping with respect to the variable zeta will apply differentiation with respect to z to the power n to this z to the m, and the result is zero unless n is equal to m, after the substitution. So basically, you will get only the diagonal coefficients will contribute, so you'll get a sum over n of a and n, and those diagonal coefficients will contribute an n factorial each. You know that. Sorry for wasting your time. I mean, everything is really, really easy. That's the point, you know. Yeah.
So basically, what you are doing is you represent operators between spaces of polynomials by kernels.
Yeah.
Except that you are doing Fourier transform with respect to the second variable.
But I don't know words, complicated words.
Yeah, I understand, but that's what. From a point of view of analysts, this is what you are doing.
Yes. Okay. Okay. So I want to emphasize not only that I don't know complicated words, but that everything that I say is real. I mean, I'm not making it up. I have programs that implement everything the programs run. So here is a tiny, tiny program. What?
It's even rational, not only real.
what?
But you work over Q, yes?
Yeah. So, I mean, everything actually is implemented. So, for example, here is the implementation of zip. So, basically, I declare that the dual variable to z is zeta, the dual variable to zeta is z. I define that doing that no zipping, that zipping with respect to the empty set of variables does nothing. And then there is some inductive definition. You don't want to look at the precise syntax, but the key point is that if you so you look at the result of the previous step of the induction, and if you have a function times zeta to the d, you replace it by differentiation with respect to the dual of zeta, d times applied to this function, and then you set the dual of zeta to zero. And this actually works. So if you compute the zipping function of, say, zeta squared e to the delta z squared, the result is, well, you can do it in your head. I mean, differentiate twice with respect to z, check which coefficients come out. The result is 2 delta. If you do zeta to the fourth against the same function of z, you'll get 12 delta squared. Check it if you don't believe me. Okay? This is actual computer code running. The result is output computed by your computer, not by me. Okay? And you can see here, by the way, that I actually didn't need p to be a polynomial. I only needed it to be a polynomial with respect to zeta. With respect to z, it could have been an arbitrary power series. Okay. Questions, comments? Okay. So now comes the most crucial theorem, the absolute main theorem. So if you look at the examples that I gave you, they all were Gaussians. So really, I need to tell you how to zip Gaussians. Okay? And here's the theorem that does it. So maybe you should skip the first assertion and go straight to the second. And I think I modified it in the minute before the talk, so now it's actually a bit different from what you have on the handout, but it's the same. Okay? And here's the statement. So if I have a polynomial, p, and I think I wanted it to be of finite degree in the zeta, but it could actually be a power series in the z's. In the z's, it could be an infinite order. But I wanted it to be finite order in the zetas. And then I multiply it by a Gaussian. So a Gaussian is something of the form, the exponential of some constant, which in itself could depend on other variables. The constant doesn't have to be simple-minded, okay? But, I mean, constant with respect to the variables that are right now being acted on. So if I look at, so it's e to the constant plus something linear in the z's, so eta I times zi, plus something linear in the zetas, so yj times zeta j, plus a quadratic in the z's and the zetas, so some qij zi zeta j. And I want to zip this thing to itself. The claim is that the answer is written here, but let me explain this answer. So first of all, q is some n by n matrix, so you look at 1 minus q and invert it, and call the result q tilde. So q tilde multiplied by 1 minus q should be the identity matrix. And then the output is the determinant of q tilde multiplied by, take the polynomial you started from, multiply it by a simpler exponential, e to the c plus eta I zi, replace every occurrence of zi that you see here with q tilde acting on multiplying zk plus yk, so some simple-minded replacement, and then zip. Okay? The point is that there are no, yeah, it's all Gaussian, it's all simple-minded computations that you all forgot a long time ago. It's actually not totally simple-minded, but it's not hard. Okay? Anyway,
this is the formula of the integral of a Gaussian.
Yeah. This is, yeah. These are all Gaussian integrals. I'm just telling you about Gaussian integrals, and you'll see that that's all you need. Okay? And it beats representation theory. Okay? That's the point. both computer time and in another sense, which I will come back to, which I've already mentioned, but I'll come back to it in a minute. Okay. I told you also that the subject of the talk shrunk to nothing, and that's good news. That's excellent news. Yeah, exactly. Good. So what's the point here? The point here is that Q is some finite matrix. I can compute its determinant. Over here, inside the zipping, over here I had lots of zeta. This was infinite order in the zetas. But this is finite degree in the zetas. So this actually makes sense. There are no infinite summations on the right-hand side, only on the left-hand side.
Ball zipping doesn't make sense.
What, this? Yeah. Well, here I had to worry about convergence. So like I had to put conditions like Q must be small in some sense, and then the zipping would take an infinite summation. But here everything is finite. Okay, now how do you prove this? So you can prove it either by some differentiation. So basically you replace Q by H bar times Q, and then at H bar equals to zero, it's easy, and then you can differentiate with respect to H bar, and you find some that the right-hand side and left-hand side satisfy the same differential equation, and you're done. Okay? So that's one way to do it. I don't know if I have the time to do the fun way. I'll go through it really, really quickly. So the fun way is to, first of all, you have to understand what are exponentials. So exponentials are kind of like the real good Hilbert hotels. You know the Hilbert hotel, right? It has infinitely many rooms. If you remove one room, it's still the same Hilbert hotel. You can also split the Hilbert hotel into two types of rooms, the even and the odds, and they are still, each of them, a Hilbert hotel. Exponentials are the same but better because they don't really use infinity. So, namely, take an exponential reservoir of x's. So look at e to the x and you think of it as, you know, a big, big, big sum in which you have, for example, 5 x's divided by 120. And then delete one x, del x. This operator here means delete one x. So you take one of the x's and scratch it. If you think about it, this is exactly what differentiation does. So it's also known as differentiation, this operator. And if you differentiate e to the x, you get e to the x. That's the Hilbert hotel property. Likewise, if you let each x choose between going to the left or going to the right, namely, you take e to the x and you apply the substitution x goes to xl plus xr, you get e to the x, you get two copies of your old Hilbert hotel. So exponential reservoirs are kind of fun to work with. They never exhaust themselves. You pull something out, you're left with the same. Okay? Let's use it in our case. So here is a graphical representation of the Gaussian that I wanted to zip. So the Gaussian that I wanted to zip was a polynomial times, I suppose the e to the c I can put into the polynomial, and then I have linears in z, linears in zetas, and quadratics. So here is the polynomial, and it has some n's on the z side and some n's on the zeta side. Okay? So it's like cubic on the z side and quadratic on the zeta side in this picture. Zeta is to the top, and Greeks are at the top, and Latins at the bottom. Now I'm compensating. Okay? Here is the exponential. So I think of eta as a coefficient, and it's eta multiplied by z. So, and I have a whole reservoir of such e to the eta times z. I also have a whole reservoir of e to the y times zeta. I touched the screen briefly, sorry. And finally, I have a whole reservoir of quadratics in the z's and the zetas with a coefficient q. Okay? All of these are vectors and matrices, but let's do the one variable case. And now, sum of the zipping means sum over all possible ways of gluing top to bottom. Okay? And there are various scenarios that may occur. So one scenario is, well, I start with A, and I want to glue it to something at the top. I may glue it to some zeta, which comes from the reservoir of quadratics. Then I flow down, and then I get a z here, and I glue it again to something at the quadratics. and then I flow down and I glue it again and again. So I go through the Q machine a finite number of times, and some convergence property tells me that the value will descend when I will decrease when I go more times, okay? And then when I out at the end, I go back and glue to the top of the P. So what's the contribution here? So if I start at A, go through the Q machine some K times, and stop at B, at the top, what's the contribution? The contribution is P evaluated at a sum of Q to the K times Z, all of this zipped. I mean, at the end, I just do zipping. And this is the same as P of Q, sum of Q to the KZ is the, what is it called? The geometric progression, 1 over 1 minus Q. So it's P of Q tilde Z times zeta, and that's exactly the one of the terms in the formula before. Likewise, there are several other types, and the most interesting remaining type is the type where you start from the Q machine and sort of loop back and swallow your own tail at the end. And the contribution there, if you think about it, becomes, well, in the scalar case, becomes Q tilde itself, and in the matrix case, becomes the determinant of Q tilde. So basically, if you do all of this carefully, you find the formula I asserted over here. Okay. Now, yeah. But again, I really mean business. Okay? So here is this formula turned into a computer program, and this computer program is the key. It's almost everything that, it's where all the action happens in what I still have 18 minutes to tell you about. Okay? So I will not go through the program except to say, Q is the quadratic, P is the polynomial piece. How do you find a quadratic? You take partial derivatives, then you subtract it from the identity matrix, Kronecker deltas, then you apply the inverse function, you get Q tilde. Here is the rule, the Z's go to Q tilde multiplied by the Z's plus the Y's. If you look at the formula I had, I mean, this is this rule here. Okay, so basically the program simply implements the mathematics. Here's the determinant of Q tilde. Okay, if you want the full program and a testing suite, they are on these websites.
This is the weak formula which all physics is based on. But
you're telling me that everything was known 500 years ago? Excellent. So why have we been using representation theory all along? Let's go on. Let's move on.
Yeah.
Okay. However, unfortunately, in the algebras I really care about, so the algebra Q U epsilon, which I will explain in a minute, things are a bit more complicated. So the R matrix is indeed the exponential of a Gaussian, and then it's multiplied by some power series, and the power series looks more like, well, looks as written here, but begins like here, but then continues. Okay, I still have to tell you where Q U epsilon came from, but just believe me that such an algebra exists, and it has a value for the crossing, and it's given like that. The stitching map, the stitching map now depends on both Greek and Latin letters. I mean, this had only Latin letters because it was a map from the empty set into some space. Okay? But this is a map between spaces, so it has both Greek and Latin letters. And the formula is given here. So it's the exponential of something messy and horrible, multiplied by 1 plus epsilon lambda plus higher order terms, where lambda is just the degree 1 piece, and it's a mess in itself. Okay? One thing to just to explain, inside this mess, so uppercase T is the exponential of a lowercase t. So it's not a single Latin letter, it's a power series in Latin letters. And calligraphic A, this isn't calligraphic A. Calligraphic, it's really uppercase alpha, the way I think about it. So an uppercase alpha is the exponential of an alpha. So here you really have an exponential in Greek letters. So the thing written here is definitely not a Gaussian and doesn't fit with my process. Except you have to look at it a second time. So you look at it a second time and you realize that you can do the zipping in two phases. So basically, you divide your variables. Well, you didn't see it, but there were actually four variables involved here, and also their Greek counterparts. So there were, there were T's. Here is a T. There were A's. Here is an A. There are X's. Here is an X, and there are Y's, and then there are their Greek, their duals. Okay? So, as a function of all of these variables, it's not a Gaussian. These things are not Gaussian. However, if you view it as a function of only alpha and, sorry, A and T, and their corresponding duals, so alpha and tau, and you think of the X's and Y's as coefficients, then these are Gaussians. And likewise, if you think of it as X and Y, and you as a function of the X and Y and Xi and Eta, and you view the other variables as coefficients, then these are again Gaussians. So basically, if you do the zipping in two phases, the tau A phase and the Xi Y phase, then, and furthermore, in the tau A phase, you think of the zeta variables in the zipping principle as tau and A, and the z var, the Latin variables as T and alpha, well, then it's a legitimate application of zipping. And likewise, in a second phase, or it actually doesn't matter in which order you do the two phases, so, but if in the second phase, if you do, you do the XY gluings, and think of the tau and as these variables as constants, and you furthermore you regard xi and y as zeta-like, and x and eta as z-like in the previous formalism, then everything works. Now, in fact, I have given you enough. I told you the zipping formula. I told you in which order to do the zipping. I told you what are the things to zip. The things to zip are written here. I didn't tell you yet where they came from, but here they are nevertheless. If you set epsilon to zero, namely you drop this term, you drop the lambda terms, this horrible mess, you're left, then I've given you complete information how to compute a certain invariant, and the invariant you get is the Alexander polynomial, and this may appear complicated, but in fact these are the best formulas we have for the Alexander polynomial. I stand behind it. Okay? People who know the Alexander polynomial should attack me so that I can confront them and tell them, no, I'm right, you're wrong. Okay? In what sense are these the best? They actually lead to extremely fast computations, and they make sense for tangles. The Alexander polynomial is an invariant of candies, right? These knotted candies at the end. But this makes sense for the pieces of the candies, and so many properties of the Alexander polynomial can be explained using these operations that I have defined. Okay. But on the other hand, you only get the Alexander polynomial, and yeah, we know everything about it. So now I want to tell you what happens when epsilon is not necessarily zero. Okay? So first of all, I want to tell you, I want to define a notion and explain why it's important. So a docile perturbed Gaussian is a Gaussian multiplied by a polynomial, or more precisely by a power series P, where the power series is docile. A power series is docile means that if you expand it in epsilon, so everything is relative to some variable epsilon, in a minute you will see where it came from. So if you expand it as a power series in epsilon, all I want is that the power of epsilon will dominate all other variables. So with respect to the other variables, I want the degree of pk to be less than actually 4 times the degree in epsilon. Okay? Now, this is generic docility. This is what I mean by docile generically. In our case, we have a certain number of variables. They have differing degrees. I think of some of them as coefficients for others. It's a little bit messy, but the point remains the same. I mean, you can read it, but probably you don't want to. You just want to remember what docile generic, what generic docility means. Okay? But this is the What? Sorry?
Does the form relate to space-time force?
No.
You sure?
Yes. Ah, no. Of course. Any time you can find a relation.
The volume.
No, I don't think. No. No, it's not related. No, it's something else. Okay. But I want to tell you why docility matters, why docility is important. The point is that I will argue that in the algebra QU, which I already told you about, or QU sub epsilon, everything, all the objects I care about, M, delta, R, the quaps, everything, are docile. So are of the form E to the Q times P, where P is docile in some set of variables, X, Y, T, A, I don't know, something. Enough, that's all. But remember that I'm sort of thinking, living in tensor powers of spaces. So I really have xi, yi, ti, ai, one variable for each element in the set of tensor components, which really correspond to the strands of the tangle. So if you have a tangle with 50 strands, I mean, these could be knotted with each other, then this set of strands will be the set S. Now, if you look at U to the tensor power S, it grows exponentially. If you look at polynomials with a bounded degree, so if you look at epsilon to the power 3 and no more, if you crop your story at epsilon to the 3, then you end up looking at polynomials of a bounded degree in a number of variables that might grow, and the set of such polynomials has a rank which in itself is a polynomial in the size of S. I think I stated it here. So the rank of the space of docile series to epsilon to the k is a polynomial in the number of variables. And that's where polynomiality comes from. So basically, all the objects that we ever need to manage are of polynomial size, and the computations with them, well, I already told you what they are, but basically, once the objects are of polynomial size, computations are also polynomial time. And that's why this is a relatively quick computation. I think I made some comments about what this reduces to at epsilon equals to at epsilon square and in general. So in fact, you could rephrase everything in terms of representation theory, but why spoil something good? Okay? I take the DO there seriously.
Do you think the Jones polynomial was computable in some smaller time than one thought?
No. The color Jones polynomial has an expansion in terms of a further variable, and the coefficients of this expansion, which in themselves are polynomials, are computable quickly. But if, okay, but... these are not finite type invariants. This is a different filtration. It's a completely different, okay? So finite type invariants are actually weak. These invariants are strong. So in fact, by explicit computation, already if you mod out by epsilon, so already if you look at epsilon to the one, what you get is stronger than the Homfli polynomial and Hovanov homology taken together. Okay, so it's okay, and you know, maybe I want to emphasize again the sense in which this is better than the Jones polynomial, the color, the representation theory. Representation theory, if you know the invariant of the trefoil knot, representation theory will not tell you how to compute the invariant of the double of the trefoil knot. To do that, you'll need another representation, and that would be even more impossible. However, these invariants do allow you to do that, and the moment you have properties like that, namely the full collection of properties, M, S, delta, whatever, no, these are the main ones, then you actually can speak about not-theoretic properties, like the genus of a knot. Okay, so these invariants a priori say things about the genus of a knot, and in practice they do. They actually do, it's not a theory. Okay, so I still haven't, yes?
So when you say stronger, you mean that there exist knots which are not distinguished by these invariants?
Yes.
Are distinguished by, this
yes. Yes.
But there also can be a situation the other way, right?
So when I say stronger, it's really an informal statement. So when you compute up to, for all knots with up to 12 crossings, Homfli and Hovanov taken together make a certain number of misses, like 100 or so are not separated, and these invariants fail to separate only 50. Okay, so I'm not telling you exact numbers. I mean, yeah. I still didn't tell you where it is coming from. And I only have 2.5 minutes. Okay? So where is it coming from? It comes, so I really only have 2.5 minutes, so I'll do it really, really quickly. The point is that if you have a semi-simple algebra, then you can think of its upper half and its lower half, its upper Borel and its lower Borel, and you can recover the algebra from one of the halves. All you need is to know that the upper half has a bracket, but also a co-bracket. The co-bracket is the bracket of the lower half, which is dual to the upper half and becomes, after duality, becomes a co-bracket. So really, it's enough to know about half about the upper triangular matrices in order to know about all about matrices. Okay? This recovery procedure is given by some explicit formulas called the Drinfeld double formalism. And the Drinfeld double formalism takes half of the algebra, so the upper triangular matrices, its bracket and its co-bracket, and constructs a double. And the double you should think of as being the original algebra, okay? But it turns out that the Drinfeld double procedure, it makes sense to multiply delta by epsilon, and the procedure still works. So now you get an algebra which you could call, I don't know if this one was going to be GLN, then this one would be GLN up epsilon. So there is some hidden parameter in GLN. And it's that epsilon which we play with. Specifically, and again, I'm running out of time, but specifically, if you start from SL2, you get CU epsilon, and it's an algebra with four generators, Y, A, X, and T, and commutations relations written here. If you quantize using standard tools, and I'm sorry for being intimidating, because quantization is not a standard thing, it's a disturbing thing, then you get a QU epsilon, which is given by these relations, and now everything makes sense. So basically, once I told you what the relations are, oh, I forgot to tell you what the co-bracket is. But anyway, these relations are enough to, basically now it's a statement. Now it's a statement which might be true or false, and I believe is true, that, what happened to my mouse? That in this algebra, stitching is given by these formulas. These formulas are Gaussian, docile perturbed Gaussians. I told you how to compose docile perturbed Gaussians. Therefore, you can compute anything you want, and quickly. And I'll stop with my usual propaganda.
Thank you very much. Any further questions or comments?
Can you, you said that this is not the finite type invariance, but another kind of expansion. But can you make a combination, so combine something that would specialize to finite type invariance and to this thing? So in other words, you take expansion in epsilon and also in H bar, and they take coefficients of epsilon
so,
to the I times H bar to the G.
I could, and in fact, H bar appeared here, right? There was an H bar, and if you expand in H bar, you get finite type invariance. Why would I want to do it? Somehow, the point is so okay. Finite type invariance were always known to be computable in polynomial time, but with an exponent that rises with the degree of the invariant. And if you restrict your attention to relatively low degrees, you get relatively weak invariants. Why would I want to weaken this? I mean, this will give me the, this, if you want, is a, gives you infinite slices of finite type invariants for the price of just the first few of them.
What did Kronecker say, really? Before modification?
God created the integers or the natural numbers. All else is the work of men. So I also modified it to fit with the present.
Thank you very much.
Oh, so on Friday, hopefully I will say a little bit more in a more relaxed form.